Dementia in Practice is recorded and produced in multiple locations. We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the various lands on which we meet. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and celebrate the diversity of Aboriginal peoples, their ongoing cultures, and connections to the lands and waters of Australia. Hi, it's Hilton Coppy here, and welcome back to Dementia in Practice, the podcast that's made for GPs and for other health professionals with an interest in dementia. Joining me, as always, are my friends and colleagues from Dementia Training Australia, Marita Long and Steph Daly. And today we're going to be speaking about the near future dystopian or utopian or happy world of the assessment of people who may or may not have a dementia. We're going to be hearing from Dr. Nicholas Ashton, who's a neuroscientist at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, and he's going to be talking about biomarkers for a dementia, or Alzheimer's, which is a technical way of saying what, Marita?
Yeah, good question. So with the advent of biological biomarkers, which is what we're going to be talking to Nicholas about, we can now more confidently know if a dementia is caused by Alzheimer's disease or not. So if you're a GP in Australia today, the reason I would encourage you to listen through Nicholas's interview is so you can get an understanding of what these tests are before you hear about them on Sunrise and have patients knocking on your door to come and have their Alzheimer's test.
Before widespread CSF test and amyloid test, you were basically saying, okay, this person has Alzheimer's disease based on the clinical profile, and this person is a healthy control based on the clinical profile. And what we know about Alzheimer's disease now is it's a process that takes 20 years. Mm. So you have many in these older, let's call them cohorts, you had many controls which were already on the Alzheimer's disease path. And also you had many Alzheimer's disease patients clinically which didn't have the traditional pathology of amyloid and tau. So when you try and do a blood test on people classified like this, it becomes quite messy and you assume that the blood test doesn't work. But now with amyloid PET and CSF, you can say this person definitely has amyloid pathology. This person definitely does not have amyloid pathology. Does the blood test work? And now the answer is yes, it does. So, and of course, it's very easy to take blood. So you can quickly get a couple of thousands of patients that come into clinic that want to be a part of research. So once you have something that you think is working, it's very easy to test on a big scale.
So we're picking up the amyloid on PET scans, is that correct? What are we testing in the blood?
The leading test that we are measuring is something called phosphorylated tau. And this is part of our biological diagnostic criteria in CSF for decades. So it's not really a surprise that it's our best one in blood. It's just, as I mentioned before, been very difficult to measure. So we're talking femtomolar levels in blood. To put this in a kind of schematic, it's like dropping 1,000th of a sugar cube into an Olympic-sized swimming pool. That's the kind of level that you're trying to measure in the blood. And it's competing with multiple different proteins. So the technology has had to come a long way, which it has done. But we've also had to understand a bit about how the protein gets processed, comes from the brain, goes through to the CSF, and then ends up in the blood. It doesn't exist as a full protein. It exists as fragments. So you have to understand and have the knowledge of which fragments to measure to get these
results. Where we're lucky we've got people like you, right? And we don't have to think about that stuff. Yeah. So why aren't we testing amyloid in the blood?
It's a good question. And we were testing amyloid in the blood. And we do have good assays that work very well. In fact, there's an approved blood test in the US by a company called C2M, which targets amyloid.
Right.
It was the first one worldwide to be approved. But it has some limitations. To put it simply, is that we express peripheral amyloid. So the diagnostic difference between someone with Alzheimer's disease and doesn't with amyloid is very, very small. It's about 5% change.
Oh, wow.
And if you take it into CSF and do the same test, it's about a 50% change.
Right.
So that still works very well. But if you want to have a test which you will run in primary care on a day-to-day basis, multiple different labs with different expertise, and you only have a 5% change, that means the kind of variability of your assay has to be absolutely spot on.
Yeah.
And 5% is too low.
Too low.
Right. So you will lose that diagnostic utility. So it's a fantastic research tool, but for clinical utility,
it's not so good.
It's not so well. But on the flip side, when you measure phosphorylated tau, this increase is about 300%, 350%. So this is a test where you can afford to have some variability across laboratories and expertise and still come up with the correct answer.
And amyloid and tau are the two changes in proteins that are involved in the neuropathological change in Alzheimer's, is that correct?
Exactly, yeah. So
right.
the leading theory is, and it's a lot of evidence-based theory, is that amyloid starts to accumulate first and actually mm-hmm. starts to accumulate before symptoms even appear.
Mm-hmm.
And then tau follows.
Right.
And that was one that really correlates more with the symptoms that you kind of see the patient exhibit, sort of the functional decline and memory decline.
And what about neurofilaments in blood? What's the story there?
So, yeah, this is another blood test that we use quite regularly. And in fact, we've had it approved in Sweden for several years. It's not a very specific test. So if you have high levels of neurofilament, this could be high for a number of reasons, and one of them could be dementia, but it could be multiple other reasons. So what neurofilament does in combination with phosphorylated tau is kind of an indicator that there is some sort of neuronal damage happening in the brain.
Right.
But it cannot tell you really what the source is. So now combining that with a test like phosphorylated tau, how we will envision it using is that you'll have both these tests done as a routine standard. Phosphorylated tau along with neurofilament light. And a number of scenarios can happen here. So phosphorylated tau is high.
Mm-hmm.
And in the clinical context of the patient, which is extremely important, this could indicate Alzheimer's disease. And then you can have the management that follows that. Now, phosphorylated tau is low, but the patient still has symptoms and neurofilament light is increased. That's still an indicator that this is a dementia type. And it kind of speeds that process to say, okay, we're not really worried about Alzheimer's disease, but maybe let's kind of investigate vascular dementia, like a Lewy body's dementia. And then the third scenario is someone has symptoms, but low phosphorylated tau and low neurofilament light. Now, this would kind of push us towards more like a primary psychiatric disorder.
Right.
Causing, well, there doesn't seem to be a dementia at play here.
Yeah,
so what's causing the symptoms? So maybe, you know, having a psychiatric evaluation would be useful in that context. Maybe it's a temporary
neurosyphilis or something. Would that potentially be?
A lot of the time, you know, metabolic disorders could cause temporary cognitive decline. I mean, as you know from a GP, you get a snapshot of someone in front of you at that time.
Yeah.
And you have very little information of what's happened before, but you're trusting their interpretation of this, maybe a carer. So you have this very kind of cross-sectional evaluation and a blood test, and there is a number of reasons that can cause that temporary memory impairment. And so these blood tests are giving us a kind of good idea of what is going on in the brain, and we can direct our treatment that way.
So I'm guessing when we're going to use them, or when they come into primary care, we're not using them for someone who's, say, got an acute onset delirium, for example, and a cognitive change, are we? We're thinking about the person who's got a picture more similar to an Alzheimer's.
Yeah, and I think this is a really important point to put across. I don't expect, and we shouldn't expect, a blood test just to completely remove a clinician, right?
Yeah.
So these biomarkers are biomarkers of pathology, and they're not biomarkers of symptoms. A dementia patient or someone with mild cognitive impairment comes in front of you. They looks like they have Alzheimer's disease. The blood test will then confirm that they have amyloid. If the blood test doesn't confirm they have amyloid, there's not much use in putting them in a drug which targets something that they don't have.
Yeah, right.
So that's really the main use, is that you should always put this blood test in context of the patient that's in front of you. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
Classic cases that we see quite regularly now is you do get amyloid pathology in cases with frontal temporal dementia, cortical basal syndrome. These are 10, 15%. So a blood test in those cases would come back positive if there's amyloid in the brain. Now, it doesn't mean you should change their diagnosis now straight to Alzheimer's disease. They still have a frontal temporal dementia.
Right.
But it just tells you that, you know, there is some sort of co-pathology happening.
Which is common in dementia, isn't it?
Exactly.
There's often a mixed pattern in there. So do you think, I'm just trying to think of, say, someone who's older, who might have had symptoms for quite a while, you've done the workup, you're pretty confident that it's Alzheimer's. We know in general practice there's loads we can do to improve the quality of life with someone with dementia that doesn't require medication or doesn't require any further testing, would this blood test help a GP to feel more confident that they've made the right clinical diagnosis? Like, could it be used without that need to go on and use a amyloid treatment?
I think so, because, I mean, if you wanted to give a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease and administer symptomatic treatment, having that extra biological information to kind of make you more confident about this. Also, if it comes back negative, I mean, that could maybe push a GP to say, okay, maybe there's something else, and maybe my management should be different, maybe my treatment should be different.
Or maybe I need another a second opinion. Not sure. So it might get those people to the memory clinic, perhaps, to be assessed. Or, as you say, look for a different pathology.
Exactly, yeah.
Steph, lots of new information. How do you imagine that you will be applying this information in your clinical practice when these blood biomarkers become more readily available?
Well, there's a lot to get your head around, isn't there? And I guess if I reflect on other blood tests that we've had in clinical practice, sometimes they can be fraught with all sorts of conditions and, you know, depending on the person and depending on the result. So we really need, I think, a lot more information before we're going to actually apply this in clinical practice. But I think thinking about what I would do is I would probably approach things as I do already. So taking a good clinical history from the person, identifying if they have any cognitive change and going through the process that we teach in our program. And then maybe I would use this, like I use the cognitive assessment tools, I'm adding to what I already have found in the clinical history to, you know, see whether or not this person might have Alzheimer's disease pathology. And we know that there are lots of other causes of dementia or cognitive impairment, but it might help me to be more confident that that was the pathology that matches the history that I found. So, yes, I think it will be useful. I think we in primary care will need a lot of support and, you know, education on how to use such a test, because I can imagine explaining it like you explain cardiovascular risk or any of these other things is going to be quite complex. And we don't want to add to the stigma that people already feel with an already stigmatized disease. So it's very exciting research, and it will be interesting to see how it all plays out. But I think for primary care, we need some safeguards and some structure around how we're going to use this information.
So Nicholas mentioned in the interview drugs that treat amyloid or that reduce amyloid. Pardon my ignorance, Marita, but what drugs is he talking about there?
I think before I get into those, I was just going to add to what Steph said in terms of clinical practice and still related to drugs. You know, at the moment, if we think someone has Alzheimer's disease and we want to start treating them with cholinesterase inhibitors like donepezil or Aricept, we have to do it in consultation with a specialist. One of the benefits of a test like this is actually we'll take that step away also, because we'll be able to have that confirmatory evidence that it is Alzheimer's disease. So we'll be more confident to be able to start medications if that's what we want to do. But the monoclonal antibodies, which have come onto the market, which are these drugs he's talking about, have been the first, you know, breakthrough, I think, for about 20 years for any drug to show any promise in the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. So interestingly, what they do is they manage to remove nearly all of the amyloid in someone's brain. So you would think if something removed all the amyloid, which we think of as one of the driving neuropathological changes in the brain, you'd get almost cure, wouldn't you? Because you've removed all that amyloid. But in fact, what we're seeing is a slowing down of cognition, potentially, for something of a small magnitude for a small amount of time. But of course, the studies are in their infancy, they're in their early stages, so we don't have years of data. We really only have 18 months and 2 years. And the other thing is, of course, we're using them in people with established symptoms and disease, so it might be that we're using them too late. So if we can identify people with amyloid or Alzheimer's disease earlier, these drugs may in fact do a lot more, and some of the research out there, they're even talking about preventing or reversing the disease process, but we're a long way off that too. You know, we've got to get the cohorts of people in, perhaps with mild cognitive impairment, to administer these medications to see what difference they'll have.
So is that like primary prevention, using a drug as primary prevention? In other words, to prevent someone ever developing the symptoms. They may have the pathology in the brain, which is indicated by having amyloid on the blood test. So the pathological process is there. But the idea of using a drug to prevent them getting symptoms before they get symptoms, which when I went to medical school in the last century was called primary prevention. Is that what we're talking about?
Not now, but I think in the long term there's some hope. These drugs offer a glimmer of hope that perhaps one day they might be able to do that. If we could do a test before someone has symptoms to see that there's Alzheimer's pathology in the brain, could we in fact prevent them ever developing a dementia? And that's the hope for the future, but we are nowhere near that yet.
So that won't be on Sunrise next week?
We hope not.
So I guess what I'm hearing you say, and perhaps a little bit what Nicholas was saying, is that there's an equating of Alzheimer's disease and the collection of amyloid and tau in the brain as the same thing, and that is the thing that leads to Alzheimer's dementia. So in other words, the accumulation of amyloid and tau is equated as Alzheimer's disease, and that's what in some people will lead to Alzheimer's dementia. Have I got that right?
Yeah, so I understand it that it's a sort of pathological or biological diagnosis. So you can demonstrate that you have that, the presence of those things in your brain means that you are at risk of developing dementia, because it also comes back to your brain reserve and cognitive reserve, so how resistant your brain is to that damage that's occurring. So not everyone who has amyloid will develop a dementia in their lifetime.
And of course, there are people out there looking at things other than amyloid and tau. We don't think we have the full picture.
That's what I was thinking. Like, it's surely it's not going to be that simple. Like, it's a tool that will hopefully become helpful as time goes on for some people, but not necessarily for everyone. And all the other things that we're still doing to keep people well, from this brain health concept that we've had along the lines of the heart health, we will still have to do that work, won't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and if you look at all the targets for medical research, all the drug and lifestyle targets that they're working on to see which ones make a difference, and there are just hundreds of them. So not all of them are related to amyloid. So
in fact, many aren't.
No, there's like immune ones amyloid. And yeah, all sorts of things. Gut biome. Yeah. So it's a very fast moving space.
And I think one of the things that Nicholas said a few times throughout the interview, and we'll probably hear more from him about this, is that we're still putting the person in the clinical context. That's our first and foremost priority, and these are kind of, I guess, the add-ons to help give us a bit more information.
So that old thing that I keep banging on about, which is called clinical judgment, will still be required. Taking a history, listening with people, finding out what their strengths, what the meaning is of things for them, will still be required.
Yeah.
We still need to treat them as pre-screens. You know, this is a blood test about a brain disorder. It's never going to be 100% perfect. Everyone's looking for a cutoff value that a GP can just say, okay, yes or no. And I don't think that's the correct way to use these tests. Mm-hmm. You're going to have two cutoffs where we're definitely sure mm-hmm. you're positive, and another cutoff where you're definitely sure you're negative. And there will be this kind of intermediate zone where you say that the blood test is not confident. And this becomes very, very important now if a drug is available to someone and your blood test is deciding whether they get it or don't. So that's how we would advise to use it, is that there will be this small intermediate zone, and it will be small. It will be about 15% of mm-hmm. individuals with mild cognitive impairment that will fall in that area. Mm-hmm. And they would have to have advanced testing. They would have to have amyloid PET scan, right. CSF test, whichever you use, to really kind of get to the bottom of what it is. But what it does, I mean, in Sweden, we take CSF all the time. So for us, it will save about 80% of these CSF tests.
Yeah, which is quite a traumatic procedure, right?
It is. I can say that in Australia that it is. Yeah. In Sweden, we're not allowed to say that.
But right.
And in the UK, they're almost not done as well. So where I was trained. So it will reduce 80% there. But mainly, I think, is that it gives an insight into the biology that maybe some clinics never had. CSF and imaging is just not an option. So they don't have the option, right? So being able to have that extra little bit of help.
So potentially some of the low and middle income countries, you know, it might have a lot more impact too, where you can't
absolutely.
Get to.
So being able to do this in areas and even for research where we have absolutely no idea about prevalence of dementia.
Yeah, right.
So moving more away from the clinic and just understanding what the prevalence is in lower income countries.
Mm.
Being able to do this now for a blood test and not having to have a very, very expensive research study, and you only get a small amount of people. Now, potentially you can do tens of thousands of people with a blood test and start to understand the prevalence of this disorder in regions that we never knew about before.
So. And what about preparation for the test? So with all sorts of different blood tests, we might have to get people to fast, or we might need to know what time they took the last dose of a medication, or, you know, we might not want to do it after heavy exercise, for example. Are there any provisos to this test?
Yeah. So first thing I want to say is that there is already like a big race about which test is the best and which company are going to provide the best test.
Right.
This was an academic test at first, for 2 or 3 years ago, and now there are companies that have come and made it better, which is great. But, you know, at the moment, there isn't any commercially available test of the best one. So for researchers, it's a little bit frustrating because they hear these talks and they read these papers, but they can't actually access it themselves. So that's a bit frustrating. So knowing about, there needs to be some consensus and some guidance about which tests are the best ones to use.
Mm-hmm.
And so for regions to then make their own decision, because I presented in my keynote, actually the alarming difference in how some of these tests perform that we do have access to through our research institution is a bit worrying. Some are absolutely amazing and some are less perfect. So,
and I think you'd mentioned that you might have to repeat the test.
Yeah, so there are some things that we need to understand a bit better. So with neurofilament light, we didn't know this until we started measuring it in thousands of people on a daily basis, that this biomarker is affected if you have chronic kidney disease, which of course is very common. It's affected by BMI.
Right.
So, but these effects are small.
Right.
They are significant, but they are small. And this intermediate zone I talked about earlier, this should capture that variance. Fasting is a difficult one. The research at the moment is a bit contradictory. We've just published one which suggests that not fasting does have an acute effect on these biomarker levels. So this is something we need to understand a bit better before we set these cutoffs. But again, as I say, I hope that the effect is so small that this kind of gray zone area would capture this kind of variance.
And will the levels be different for men and for women?
From what we know from a lot of patients we have, there doesn't seem to be any sort of sex effect on these biomarkers.
Yeah, right.
They would only be changed with the comorbidities that come
with
the patients. So if a certain comorbidity is more prevalent in men, then of course on the group level, it looks like there's an effect.
Right.
But these cutoffs and the suggested cutoffs we have doesn't seem to be different on the individual level.
So would you ever see this as a, like, when everyone turns 40, for example, in Australia, if there's any risk factors, they're eligible to have diabetes screening done.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that blood biomarkers will get to eventually so that we can sort of pick up that very early mild cognitive impairment stage, perhaps, or pre that even, that there's some...
I wouldn't know where to set that age, but I think that this is definitely a possibility of where we're going. And there are many clinical trials testing the drugs that we know are working in symptomatic patients. They're already being tested in pre-symptomatic patients.
Yeah, right.
So that is being done right now, reducing amyloid and seeing whether that kind of alleviates the conversion to symptomatic disease. And if that proves to be positive, you can definitely see this being a part of a routine age diagnostic workup, 60s, 55, as you suggested, and this was being part of that kind of panel.
Right.
And that's being put on an amyloid reducing agent early, and just reducing amyloid for a few years. Maybe you don't have to be on the drug for life, just a few years, as the drug trials are showing us, is that it clears amyloid within a year of being on the drug. So I think that this is probably where we will go. It's not going to be next year.
No.
I think it's going to be a decade or even more. But I think these blood tests will be very informative to do this. And I think it's the only way you can do this, because, of course, we'll never be able to screen everyone. I presented some data to suggest that you could do this with a finger prick test as well.
Yeah.
This is very, very early research, but it definitely looks promising that someone could potentially collect blood themselves unsupervised, send it away.
A bit like your home fecal occult blood test.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But maybe with a few more ethical dilemmas perhaps at this stage as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is going to be very, very useful for right now. We could use it for people that are on or will start to receive the drug.
Yeah.
And then you have a much narrower window of what's going on, more personalized management. Is the blood test lowering? Is it getting higher? Do we need to call you in? Is this a concern?
Well, I think we are so lucky that there are people like you that brains work in this way to be able to figure out all this amazing research, you and all the other people who seem to have contributed to this space. I was going to ask you if you had one take-home message that you've learned from being at ADRF.
It's not a very exciting take-home message. It's actually a bit of a kind of a wake-up call. Is in every healthcare society around the world is very different.
Mm.
And the context of use, not just of blood biomarkers, but also the new drugs that we're getting and other tests, they need to have a huge infrastructure around them and a basic information of how to use them. We're not ready. This is out of my realm. More funding is needed, not on the research or the drugs now, but just personnel. You know, we're going to have an influx of people that will demand to be treated, will demand to be tested. That's what I learned from Australia. It's very different from Sweden, but facing the similar problems.
Yeah.
You know, how are we going to implement this?
And it really is that equity of access
as
well. You know, there's a lot to think about, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
That you've got to think, you know, is this going to be a drug that's going to just be available to wealthy people, for example? There's a lot to work out, but it seems like there's going to be a lot of pressure to work it out because the research is racing ahead, isn't it?
Exactly. Dementia has had so many failings over the last two decades and so many promises. And now you're giving another promise, and it would be a tremendous shame that we have the tools and we have the drugs now. The next failure would be infrastructure.
Yeah.
That would be really devastating, I think.
Yep.
Don't want to end on too gloomy a note. The next failing would be a failing of infrastructure. What can we do to help move things forward from where things are now in clinical practice?
That's a big question, Hilton.
That's my job, to ask the big questions.
I mean, I guess what we're doing by spending a lot of time together, educating around the aspects of dementia and recognizing people who have dementia and encouraging, I guess, a timely diagnosis, and then looking at all those great interventions that we can put in place to try and slow down the progress of dementia and improve the quality of life. I think that's what we need to keep doing, because if we can do that, we're going to prepare our community, including our medical community, to be ready to embrace some of these new options, like having blood biomarkers or having potential treatments. And, you know, we've heard a lot throughout the proceedings of the conference about getting data onto registries also, so that we are in a space where we can really help drive the changes that are necessary to support much better outcomes for people living with dementia.
Being a GP, we are the masters of change, because things are constantly changing and we have to be kind of alert to that. And often it's directed by patients coming in and asking us questions. And I suppose my hope is that somehow we can translate some of this stuff that's happening in research, which will impact our practice in a smoother way, so that we're not kind of, it doesn't just appear in the consultation room and you've got to decipher it from the local newspaper, trying to understand exactly what the person in front of you is asking.
Great thoughts, Steph. And thanks again, Marita, for all your efforts in bringing us these interviews from the Australian Dementia Research Forum. There'll be more information in the show notes section of today's episode, and we look forward to seeing you again on the next episode of Dementia in Practice.
Dementia in Practice is an initiative of Dementia Training Australia, which is funded by the Australian Government.
If you are a GP and you'd like to claim CPD points for listening to this episode, check out our suggestions in the show notes section.